Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. We were going to do our show live tonight from Ferguson, Missouri. I'm kidding. Everyone else but us has done a show from there, but we'll have lots of comments about the incidents and the trauma and the overstatement of some things that are going on there. But a very interesting case in point, and we'll discuss it from several angles tonight, as will our guest speaker. From C-SPAN Morning Show, Eugene O'Donnell. He's a New York City police officer for 2 years, 1982 to 1984, and he served as a lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Lecturer, I think, I don't know, but I think it's probably their lowest rank there, but maybe he just got started at that. But he has some interesting comments to help people understand what police do, because I've heard so much misinformation. I don't tell them, but I could tell them, get a copy of Bohm and Haley's Introduction to Criminal Justice, 8th edition with McGraw-Hill, and the 3 chapters on policing will dispel many of the myths that have been put forward from this Ferguson, Missouri incident. And I'm not minimizing at all what happened. I mean, we need to let justice take its course, but I think we've overdone it in some ways. In the same time that this has gone on, we have dozens of people being shot in Chicago and New York and all kinds of things. But anyway, thank Johnny Cash on his little trip across the country as he sings that lovely song. And keep in mind, he does that from memory. Why doesn't somebody try to do that? Get the lyrics to Johnny Cash's song there that we'd use for the theme song, I've Been Everywhere Man, and let me see if you can do it from memory. I want to thank everybody else. Audrey, thank you. Mike Sorrento, Lucy Spears for gathering data for us. And what we're going to do tonight is discuss issues and events that relate to criminal justice. We're going to make our news segment a little short. Let's call it abbreviated, in order that we can listen to Mr. O'Donnell talk about the nature of policing and have him respond to callers that are calling in. Our show, keep in mind, is dedicated to these corrections, police, court, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the U.S. and the world. Keep in mind, I never mention this much, but the people who work with juveniles and juvenile delinquents and juvenile detention centers, that is a very hard job. You're almost allowed to do nothing to them, and I don't mean to harm them, but even to control them, and it's a high turnover job in corrections officers anyway, but for juvenile work, it's much worse. I better check that corrections officer turnover. It may not be as high for adults anymore since the professionalization movement has taken hold. But anyway, you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Keep in mind you can have your own radio show in a matter of minutes. You can sign up yourself and be broadcasting worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. Worldwide, it doesn't cost you anything. I always say, what would somebody in 1980 think if they heard that? What did it take to get on the radio in those days? Who knows? Well, let's take a look at some of this criminal justice news. And in this first article, I'm not going to really beat up on Professor Brian Howell, but he is a professor at Wheaton, Illinois, and Wheaton University. Do they call it Wheaton College still? They might call it still Wheaton College. Yeah, Wheaton College in Illinois. Very fine Christian institution with many famous graduates in the ministry and service and all kinds of things. But he said he was riveted and horrified by the live feed coming out of Ferguson. He were advanced like shock troops against protesting citizens and journalists doing their job. Well, I think they were also protecting those journalists doing their job, but the facts have emerged that the Ferguson police that make some of this conflict more understandable, for example, only have three black officers in this suburb that is probably about 70, I think it's about 70% black. And one of the myths there that he didn't do it, but others have gone on and said about it, they're talking about how underrepresented blacks are in American law enforcement. Well, again, get out your Introduction to Criminal Justice, 8th edition by Robert Boehm and Keith Haley. That's me, by the way. And take a look and see that the number of percentage of black officers in American law enforcement throughout the United States is about equal to the percentage of African Americans in the American population. 12-some percent, 13% of that definition. Now, the problem is distribution. You go out in Wyoming, you go out in western Iowa, you go out in someplace out in the farmlands, they have no black officers and they don't have any black residents either. I mean, that doesn't mean that they couldn't recruit nationally and bring people in, which some have, by the way. You know, Dallas started recruiting back in the 1970s nationwide. They make 6-7 trips across the nation going to colleges and universities. They used to come down to the University of Cincinnati and recruit students, and we got them a lot. Good people that were doing that. But he's noted following the riots in 1968, he said the relationship between political disenfranchisement and violence. He talked about the insufficient training police officers receive in community relations and social dynamics. And, you know, I actually started to answer him. I never do that. And somehow it wouldn't take my answer on his blog. But having headed up the Law Enforcement Commission in the state of Ohio that designs and oversees the training, I can tell you they get lots of training in human and community relations and social dynamics. He is missing a lot. He does not know what he's talking about. History, social science, empathy, complex problem solving, clinical thinking. Does he also know that many, many large police departments in the United States and some small suburban ones used to have an IQ test till everybody jumped in on him and said, you know, you can't require 110 IQ. Well, they still do a number of ways, but a lot of agencies drop their IQ tests. I don't know any job in society, including Supreme Court justice, that goes through 18 or 19 or 20 different distinct steps to get the job like a police officer. Nobody's even close. I won't go into all that, but it's a very long, drawn-out process, and agencies want to be very careful about that. he said one of his students jumped in a police car and rode along in a nearby suburb for a while, and he said the whole thing was fascinating. He said, but when I suggested that perhaps he'd found a career path, he brushed it off. It was a fun project, but I could never be a cop. Why not? Cops make a difference in people's lives, as he said. And here's another myth. Most people think that cops spend most of their time in the large spent on crime in the largest cities in the United States. The largest cities in the United States and the largest police departments, only about one-third of their calls have anything to do with the crime. The rest are service and public service and peacekeeping, you know, getting the kids out of the street on skateboards, peacekeeping. They're not arresting them. They're not shooting at them. Service could help people. I could tell you, having been a cop for 5 years in a large city, many, many things of what I did was helping people. I might even sit here. We had a 400-plus-pound woman used to fall out of bed. We'd get a call every once in a while, once or twice a month, to put her back in bed, and we wouldn't help. Nobody minded that. That was our job. I've helped old limping people carry their groceries for 3 or 4 blocks down the street as a cop. I tried to get out of my car and meet as many people as I could so that I felt like I was a member of the community. And I'm not the only one in America that ever did that, as you would certainly recognize. So I hope Professor Brian Howell gets tuned up on what really goes on in American policing, because he's way off on this particular thing. I know his heart's in the right place. And that's why I'm glad that he's wanting students to get in there. But does he also know we have thousands of criminal justice programs in the United States? In fact, we helped build, when I was the head of the Law Enforcement Commission in Ohio, 12 different college academies and associate degree programs. I graduated from one of the top doctoral programs. I didn't get a doctorate, but a master's degree from Michigan State. And I went to the University of Cincinnati, which offers doctoral programs just like Michigan State. And I was the chair of their program and graduate program for a long time. And what he does not know is that there are thousands and thousands of criminal justice majors at all levels around the United States. And he acts as if nobody with a college degree or a social science background ever becomes a cop. Last, and I'll stop. August Vollmer, the chief of police of Berkeley, California, started hiring college graduates in the early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s. So that's how long police departments have been interested in hiring college graduates. Okay, enough about that. Thought this was interesting that Eric Holder and everybody's responded all over the place, the Department of Justice had ignored an unarmed woman slain by police, and this was in Washington, D.C. Have you heard about that one? Attorney General Holder, he's in Ferguson, or was, but what he's not investigating is the shooting of an unarmed African-American woman by his own federal officers in his own jurisdiction. He hasn't done anything about that, and this is kind of interesting. Many people think it was a wrongful death, but what happened to her is this is a woman this investigation was conducted by the Secret Service, the arm of the Uniform Division of the Secret Service, in other words, the White House Police, Capitol Police officers, and she made a wrong turn and turned around, and they started chasing her. Make a long story short, they end up shooting her and killing her. So Eric Holder hasn't done anything about that one yet, and there's a lot of really strange circumstances. Look that one up on the Internet. About this Capitol Police shooting. Very interesting. By the way, law enforcement officers, this is a new article out of the Washington Times, law enforcement officers were cleared more than 400 times a year for justified homicides. More than 400 fatal police killings a year are sanctioned by local, state, and federal authorities as justified homicides. But the FBI doesn't specifically track how many times officers are prosecuted for improperly causing a person's death. So all these shootings, which isn't much when you consider the population of the United States and the thousands and thousands of police departments across the United States and the thousands of police officers, 400 times a year, they end up shooting somebody in a justifiable homicide. And, this law has changed over the years. I won't go over the last 50, but it used to be you could shoot any fleeing felon. Now you can't. You can't actually do that. They have to have some type of threat and that type of thing. So we'll see what happens over in Ferguson, Missouri, if they let this thing run the course. But you got the politics of the prosecutor, the grand jury, the governor intervening, and on and on and on. I thought this was a good one. Mayor Bloomberg Remember him, billionaire Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City? He came up into Milwaukee and he tried to stop them, their gun law. And, boy, he's the former mayor of New York, made a huge political miscalculation when he sauntered into Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a solid blue county that overwhelmingly votes Democrat, thinking he could stop this, he could disarm the citizens in that community. He was willing to spend $50 million of his wealth to help defeat any pro-gun candidate. Well, guess what? Michael Bloomberg's anti-gun money went up in smoke as the pro-gun sheriff wins in Wisconsin. He's a Democrat. We've talked about Sheriff David Clark, very sharp guy, very articulate, and he's a Democrat, and he's the one, he encourages his people to get a right to carry license and to get a firearm in their home for safety. Isn't that interesting? And the mayor thought he could knock him off on that thing. I think what we'll do on this, we'll stop with the news story about the Ferguson looter. And this Ferguson looter, he's running around crazy. The National Guard arrived in Ferguson, of course, but kept its distance from the streets. One of the protesters is running around out there, and one looter who came out of a Quick Trip, I guess that's a fast food place, I know, a convenience store, he told the Washington Post that he was proud of what he was doing. I'm proud of us. We deserve this, and this is what's supposed to happen when there's injustice in your community. That's DeAndre Smith. He told the Post, the St. Louis, not going to take this. We're not going to take this anymore. So he thinks looting is totally justified and get what you can get. Well, let's do a blonde joke tonight. I don't think we've done this one before, but let's try it. This blonde joke is, why did the blonde get fired from her job in the fields at a banana plantation? Or in the orchard, whatever that is. Well, she kept throwing away the bent bananas. She thought there was something wrong with them. What do you think of that? She was throwing away the bent bananas. She thought something was wrong with them. I don't like that one. Okay, this one's a little bit of advertising. Here's my green tip of the night. Get a commuter fold-up bicycle if you work in the city or close to the city. I just bought one. It came from Sugar Land, Texas. It's a wonderful, it's called Green Zone Bikes. It folds up. You carry it in a bag. It unfolds, and you can get 7 speeds. And, I mean, it runs as good as, you know, for example, a older Schwinn Collegiate or something like that. But a Shimano Gears, it's beautiful. Go to greenzonebikes.com and take a look at that. And just think of the energy you'll be you'll be saving by riding that instead of driving around in cabs and, taking your car out to lunch and that kind of thing. You can just fold that bike up. It comes with a bag. It comes with a bell. It comes with a water bottle. It comes with a back thing. And guess what? This thing is at less than $200. I mean, I couldn't believe that. If you get a day home bike, they make lots of folding bikes. Their bikes are like $800, $900. You know, $1,000. I even saw one of them was $5,900, a folding bike. Now, I don't know what that does for you. Maybe that one's electric. I don't know. But anyway, these bikes from, and he's a wonderful business model, this guy, down in Sugar Land, Texas. And he says it's going to be there on a certain day. It's there. But anyway, that would save you some time, money, and energy if you actually got one of these Green Zone bikes. And if you buy one, tell him I'm advertising for him. But a really ingenious idea. He doesn't have distributors. He mails direct. They assemble them. It comes all right there. And, boy, like 4 steps, and this thing folds up and unfolds and locks very securely when you're riding it. You'll probably hear me gab about this a little bit more in the future. Let's take some time out here. Let me get set up, and we'll listen to Eugene Earle, lecturing professor at the College of Criminal Justice in New York City, or John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and that's a very good program, academic program at that place. Give me a time here to set it up and we'll go.
Joining us from Chicago this morning is Eugene O'Donnell. He's a lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a former police officer for the New York Police Department, serving from 1982 to 1984. Mr. O'Donnell, what is the role of the police force in Ferguson, Missouri?
Well, at this particular juncture, it's to try to engage the community, and hopefully with community engagement, and there's reason to believe that's occurring, at least on some level, peace can be maintained, order can be maintained. The small number of people apparently are traveling there to create havoc in the town can be driven out and taken into custody. And then, of course, there's some long-term issues. Many of them, by the way, are political issues. What we're seeing here is really a collapse of civic society and a broken political system at that level. And really, a lot of this conversation is about a broken political system throughout the country.
Yeah, we can talk more about it at large. What is the role of the National Guard in Ferguson, Missouri?
Essentially, to give assistance and to be there to assist with perimeters. But obviously, this is all being done by the seat of the pants. There was not a tremendous amount of time to plan this. So this is all contingency planning. And fortunately, from all accounts, the proper focus remains on convincing the people, and I don't think they don't need a lot of convincing in the community, that whatever damage has been done, that there is a need for justice to be done, but that there can only be bad result from violence and damage, and if property is damaged, businesses are hurt there, that could have an impact that would go on for decades.
Talk about all the different law enforcement presence on the ground in Ferguson, Missouri. You've got county police, you've got the highway patrol. Who are all of these, what are all of these police forces and how do they work together?
Well, we have 18,000 police departments in the country, and we've got state police, local police, county police. So it's an amalgam of those folks coming together, and you know that raises questions about chain of command. When you talk about crowd control, training is an issue, whether they've had expertise in doing it. That's usually the best indicator. So you have to plan for every contingency. You have to plan for the long term. But you also have to, again, actively engage because we saw this, we've seen it already in Ferguson. We saw it at Occupy Wall Street. The people at Occupy Wall Street refused to allow, for the most part, people to come in, you know, who are bent on anarchy and bent on hurting people.
You've got Thomas Jackson, who's the Ferguson police chief. You've got Captain Ronald Johnson, who is the Missouri Highway Patrol. What is the chain of command?
I'm not clear what the chain of command is, and ultimately these are political issues. So the governor has inserted himself properly, and so there's a mix of police decisions being made and political decisions. And chain of command is a crucial question as to what the division of labor is and who can give orders. And we don't have a whole lot of experience, fortunately, in incorporating the National Guard in peacetime. So it's a process of learning. And getting the balance right here is exquisitely difficult. You could probably criticize this response at every level and be right, because it's difficult. The first night, there was criticism of overreaction. That followed in short order with criticism of underreaction, where merchants were saying they felt unprotected. So the two best police departments in the country, probably on crowd control, LAPD, NYPD, have both been tarnished by their own issues. LAPD for not acting quick enough in MacArthur Park and making arrests. NYPD in 2004 at the Republican convention for being too aggressive and being accused of stifling people's right to assemble and be heard.
Are you saying that you can't distinguish the chain of command in Ferguson, Missouri? Or in general, is there just not a clear chain of command?
In general, you're talking about a larger issue than a local police department can deal with, so then you're bringing in an outside of chain of command, and how well prepared an organization is on paper is one issue, and how well those plans come together in reality is another question. So some areas of the country, there's probably some very good coordination around civil disorder. Some communities, much less so. And all these plans are really only can be evaluated when you got to stand them up and make them work in real time. And, you know, there's no victory laps here. There's no winners here. You have to work on this minute to minute. You can have a good day followed by a bad day. And this takes a sustained focus. And people get tired, and including the leadership, and you have to account for that. The longer it goes on, the more weary people are liable to become, and you have to figure out how to bring fresh people in while maintaining, command structure.
What is the training like for the police force to deal with what we're seeing in Ferguson, Missouri, the aftermath of the shooting death of Michael Brown?
It would vary greatly in this country. So every department almost would have their own unique brand of training, and some would be fairly sophisticated. Some would be rudimentary. Almost all of it would be inadequate. We don't do a great job training the police in America. Again, partially because we really don't want to come to grips with what they do, which is use force on people. And it's obviously they do a lot of other things. But the core competency that they get called on to do is use force in a brutal system that we own, and then we don't want to come to grips with that. So a lot of police training will be basic and in some cases non-existent essentially, and will not be hands-on and will not give people particular skills. And even where they do, the history of this is when you actually have to have a response, That's when you can make a better assessment of how well people are trained.
We're talking with Eugene O'Donnell, a former New York Police Department officer and lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, joining us this morning for a discussion.
I think someone should point out, perhaps to this professor who was a cop for only 2 years, that this is Haley talking, that police officers perform hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of tasks. And the biggest question in police training is, when does basic training end and advanced training begin? In other words, cops go to school their entire career. All state law enforcement training councils and commissions require that every year or every 2 years you have to have so much advanced training. So what would you have it in? You have to pick, is it civil disturbance? Is it firearms training? Is it community relations? Is it public speaking? Is it first aid, medical skills? I mean, on and on and on. So I wanted to point that out to make sure that folks understand that.
Talk about the role of police in civil disturbances. There's been a lot of discussion about the militarization of police across this country. Is the training available for the equipment that these police officers are receiving?
Well, there's real serious concerns about militarization of police and giving weaponry and whether there's oversight that's adequate. And if you only had a couple of hundred bad police departments in the country, that would be a dilemma, and something tells me you probably do out of 18,000. So there has to be oversight. But that can't be balanced with denial about reality. I'm sitting in Chicago today at this very minute. There's a hostage situation in the suburbs. You have active shooter situations. You know, the incident in 9/11 when I was in that city, and any New Yorker will remember, not knowing the scope of that attack and how long it would go on for. The events in Boston. We have to reckon with the reality. Boston. We have to reckon with the reality that the police chiefs I know are not dying to get their hands on weaponry. They're really conflicted over this. They have to be ready for eventualities, and the likelihood is, again, the overreaction, underreaction criticism. We're spending a lot of time on the overreaction side. There is another side about this where the police can be accused of not acting.
All right, well, let's get to phone calls. By the way, fourth line this morning for law enforcement, 202-585-3883. Barbara, you're up first in Connecticut, Democratic caller. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
Okay, what I want to say is I don't quite understand why they would send in so much, so many law, so many different police officers. And none of them seem to have too much training to be working with all of that heavy equipment. It just seems so long, and, you know, it's like little boys running, you know, so happy to put on helmets and have guns and be on television, and they just look.
You talk about naive. That caller is about as naive as you can get. Police officers go through hundreds of hours of basic training, and then they have required advanced training their entire careers.
Silly, and they're killing people and hurting people unnecessarily. They need to just not do this. Just have the National Guard, everybody else go. Just have them in case anything happens to work along with the local police.
Okay. All right. Eugene O'Donnell?
Yeah, we need to take the ideology out of this conversation. This is not a political conversation. It's a pragmatic conversation. It's a conversation about the law and what's necessary to do. And we've had reports, obviously, of the police looking heavy-handed. But at the very same time, there were merchants claiming that the police were standing down and not protecting them. And I think if you talk to the residents there, by all accounts, they're ambivalent about the situation. They're concerned about police, you know, looking militarized. They're also concerned about the future of their community. And the history of this is, in this country, where there have been riots, many of the communities that have been hit with riots never recovered. They just never simply don't ever recover. And so those are the balancing acts the police have to do. And, again, all this being done in our name, so let's not pretend. Because a lot of the issue that hangs out here is our failure to come to grips with what the police do in this system that we own. And I just have to say I find it amazing how elected officials who are the partners of the police in this, I see people running for cover and not acknowledging. It's an imperfect system. It's a brutal system. It's a system based on force. But when you say that it's not working perfectly, it seems to me you have a duty to tell us what could be done better in a practical way, not to deny the realities of what the police have to deal with, which are many different challenges and an unpredictable situation. For example, in this situation, clearly there are people coming to this town for the purpose of going head-to-head with the police to get on cable television for 7 seconds and to cause destruction to the people that live in the town. So you have to reckon with that.
LA Times put together this graphic, military surplus equipment for the local police, equipment acquired by the state and local police departments since 2006, 345 mine-resistant vehicles, 407 helicopters, over 1,200 night vision equipment, 5,100 armored vehicles, and almost 80,000 automatic rifles. This is from the LA Times. Eugene O'Donnell, you have thoughts on that?
My thought is, the conversation is, how did this happen? How did police get this equipment? It just arrived there, they snuck it in? Was there not a process? In recent days, I've seen elected officials, United States senators, saying Washington allowed this to happen. They are Washington. And the reasons these are happening is there is serious issues that law enforcement is confronted with. Some of it has to do with things like criminalizing drug abuse, a broken mental health system, where the elected officials could step up and do their job and help the police and admit that this is they're the architects of the system we live in. But rather than do that, apparently, across the political spectrum now, it's the street officers that are going to be blamed for these issues. We have to have ownership of this. The governor's statement today, even the president, the idea of pushing this down and making a street police issue. We have a lot of Fergusons in this country. We have a lot of disinvestment and denial about the circumstances on the ground. And the idea that we're just going to simply make this into a citizen police interaction conversation, I just find that very disingenuous.
So, Eugene O'Donnell, in your opinion, it's the lawmakers and the laws that they have put on the books.
Absolutely. It's us. And it's us. We operate an incarceration nation. We have a tremendous amount of broken infrastructure, like mental health. We don't want to confront. I think in many ways we want to say we're too good to run the system that we run. It involves taking people's freedom, giving the people police a chance to take liberty, and we have a legislation factory in every state, in the federal.
Again, I think the lecturer, the professor from John Jay, needs to get into some data and see what happened when we finally realized after 30 years that if we locked up the bad guys, the crime rate soared to the bottom. And as of about 4 years ago, we've had the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years. Are there people in prison? Yes. Are they more better cared for there than them being out on the street committing more crimes? Yes, it's cheaper to put them in the prison because they don't get caught every time they commit robberies, burglaries, etc. And some of the best are full-time professional burglars, and they don't get caught hardly at all. Back to Professor.
Government, more laws, more statutes, more opportunities for the police to be in conflict with people. The apparent triggering incident in Ferguson is two young people walking in the street. Many of your listeners will be surprised that how many states have statutes like that that actually get the police into these conflicts. And then we express horror to find out. There's bad endings in some situations where you have these conflicts. We want to be reassured the police can make it all better, and using force can be done in some magic way where there's not going to be any bad endings. The only way to reduce these kinds of issues is for political leadership to lead and to reduce the amount of conflict that police are being thrust into, in particularly in communities where the political leadership is so bankrupt, where people are not engaged, they're alienated, and the only services on offer often are policing services.
Okay. Carterville, Illinois. Jane, Independent.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. On the last question about sending Obama to Ferguson or not, I say no, because when it comes to race relations in the past, he's always thrown gasoline on a situation. He's never helped. And the sending Eric Holder, Eric is just one of those ACLU radicals, and I stress the word radical, and I don't think he wants to find a solution and find peace. Not Eric Holder. That's not his style.
Okay. All right, James. Mr. O'Donnell, do you have any thoughts on the Attorney General headed there today? He's going to be meeting with FBI agents, and also that the Justice Department is doing this parallel investigation alongside the police force there.
I think it's a nonpartisan failure across the board in this country on so many levels. And the plan apparently is to go in, make it a police issue. Obviously, justice should be done in this case. To get in, push the responsibility down, deny how many situations we have like Ferguson, and get out. And every party, every single person that I'm aware of across the political spectrum shares the responsibility for that. Is there anybody even pretending to have a plan in this country for how you engage people where you have such high rates of unemployment, failed education? This is an effort to turn away. And we, especially a C-SPAN audience who are engaged, we have to talk about the need to engage people, to have civic engagement, to have people voting, to have people being active. That's the root of this. And elected officials seem to really not want to own up to their ownership of this, and it would be perfectly acceptable for them to make this a patrol officer issue.
Okay. Tom is a law enforcement official in State College, Pennsylvania, Independent caller. Tom, your thoughts.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. O'Donnell.
Good morning.
I'm retired from the NYPD. I went on in 1968 and left as you were leaving in 82 or 84. I forget when you came on. When I came on, this going on in Ferguson, as we're aware of, isn't new stuff. This has been generational. This began in the early 60s. When I came on in 68, Ferguson was times 10 or 15 or 20 different places. We had not only Black Panthers, we had the Black Liberation Army. We had a lot of different groups looking to kill cops. And we've got to come to grips with the racial aspect of this.
Tom, can I ask you, when you were in the police force, did you have any sort of training to deal with race issues, racial sensitivity?
No, we used common sense. We used the plain old common sense. You treat everybody like you'd like to be treated. That was the training we received, and it was effective.
Okay. And Gene O'Donnell?
Well, we have to come to grips with the reality that racism is a big issue in law enforcement. It's a big issue in society. It's particularly problematic because in law enforcement, you have people sworn to protect the law equally. And we have to also, in this conversation, just remember that extremism begets extremism. This is not cheering for a team. This is not police are never wrong or the police are never, right. This is trying to find the sensible middle ground where most people, where most people are. And but we do have to reckon with the fact that, we have a society where the carryover in law enforcement often is racism. I'm hopeful.
Mr. O'Donnell has missed something. There was a whole police community relations effort for about 20 years starting after the 1960s. In fact, all the colleges offered a course in police community relations, and most all the training in the state divisions required some training in police community relations. And again, Mr. O'Donnell is correct in saying that, it's up to the officer to exercise, or the caller, common sense. And when we selected officers with high IQs and they went on the police department, they had common sense and they could apply that to the dozens and scores of hundreds of situations they find themselves in. Back to the speaker.
As the country gets more diverse and the younger generation comes along and people have mixed with people different than themselves, that those edges will be muted and that we can create a culture where officers themselves find it intolerable to engage in patterns of discrimination and bigotry, which would take us a lot further along in creating professional law enforcement.
Is training needed?
Training is always needed. I mean, if you think of the responsibilities the police have, it's an extremely skilled job. This calls for an extraordinary amount of capacities and probably should have, 4 years of training or some such thing for the actual, if you make an inventory, especially in the big cities, of what a cop could do in 8 hours, it's staggering. And they're on the front line with the power to take somebody's life without any due process. And, we really have to own this. We have to stop pretending this is not our system. And we have to engage these issues. Do we want to spend the money? Do we want to reimagine this? Speaking of extremism, you've got people running around. It seems to be a significant number of people that just wish you didn't need the police. Just hope away problems that, the police are some sort of sinister outfit that's imposed on us. That's really a distorted vision of reality. I get the point that people are unhappy to see scenes of violence and weaponry. I think cell phones are making us unhappy when we see what the police do in our name. That would be really good if we took it to the next level and started initiating reforms in a nation that is so punitive and that spends so much time locking each other up.
Okay, Democratic caller, Tennant. Centerville, Alabama.
Hi, how are you?
Morning.
I sort of have a couple of things to say. I'm just an everyday Joe. I'm from Chicago, and now I reside here now, Alabama. And I kind of wonder if people realize that sometimes African-Americans are just really tired of the police, period. I have seen so many bad things in Chicago. I mean, I understand they have a hard job, but to strip people in the street, to throw people on the ground, to step on people, to do those kind of things, and then to call them being a concerned citizen, and say, hey, they're selling drugs across from my house. Then the next thing they do is go there and tell the judge, don't you call him?
Oh, sorry, Kenneth. I thought you were finished. Eugene O'Donnell?
This is a concern you hear a lot, but the only answer to democracy is to be involved and to participate and to sit, and rail and disown our responsibility for this. That's not an answer to anything. Police are in the middle of conflicting demands all the time. We hear about brutality and overreach, while at the same time, in many places, millions of Americans, with their number one complaint about the police is they can't get their attention. They can't get them to come and take care of their issues. They've been awake for 2 years because of noise, and nobody will engage the issue. And you need to know that if you have a noise complaint and you bring the police, and the police ask somebody to lower their radio, and they don't do it, that's the issue for policing. What say you when somebody refuses to do that? Police can talk to them nicely. Police can cajole them. In many cases, police can overlook it. But that is a issue where you may have to have enforcement. And are you willing to own that? Or do you want to, have a conversation in which denial is what you want to say? This is an issue that we see a lot, where police officers do the very best they can, not all of them, but a lot, to get people to acquiesce to lawful authority, to these many laws we make, to these laws that are made by lawmakers. And somebody says, you're under arrest, and the person says, I'm not coming. What say you about what the police should do at that point?
Well, the USA Today has the caption headline, How Police Train to Stop a Threat. How do they train to stop a threat? In this article, it says shooting multiple times at a suspect is not unusual.
Yes, because the only reason to be firing a weapon is your life hangs in the balance, for the most part, in a professional police department.
I have to comment on this one, and I would think Mr. O'Donnell would perhaps know about it. The New York City studied, I forget how many years of shootings, but hundreds of shootings, and there are police shootings in their department, and they found out that in these shootings, within 7 yards, the police only hit the target one out of three times. One out of three times within a shooting range of 7 yards. So you're taught to shoot more than once if your life's in jeopardy. We'll continue with Mr. O'Donnell.
And so if you were in a life and death struggle where you believe you're going to die, how many shots would you fire in that circumstance? Would you fire one shot? Where you believe your life was hanging in the balance. Actually, as a prosecutor, I investigated police shootings, the ones sometimes you're worried about, this will sound terrible and it's a difficult balance, would be a one-shot shooting. Because you'd be saying, officer felt that he was imminently going to die and fired one shot. Police have very basic firearm skills. They miss a lot. People will recall the Empire State Building shooting in New York where they fired at an assailant and hit 9 bystanders. It's because we really don't want to turn the police into Marine snipers. They're our neighbors. They're ordinary civilian people. You want to give them basic competency. Also need to know that police officers shoot sometimes. And when they do hit, sometimes they hit people multiple times, and those people are still able to kill the police. But we need to say, in a city like New York, where there's been some recent criticism of an in-custody arrest, that the record in that city, and I'm sure in many other places, is an extraordinary police restraint. 35,000 police officers, perhaps as few as 50 shootings a year with adversaries, and almost in every single case, a person is armed and brandishing a weapon.
Milton, Florida. Shannon, Republican caller.
Hi. One of the things I was, when I was watching all the looters and everything, why can't the police use dye packs, like a paintball gun, but a dye pack that can't wash off, for weeks, that shows under ultraviolet, so that they can catch these people. They don't have to worry about apprehending them right then and putting lives on the line and, you know, sending police officers to their, you know, to their death, basically, not sending them into a mob situation like that where they would have to use live ammunition.
Okay. Eugene O'Donnell.
Well, we actually need to be much more creative in using technology to save life, reduce risk, make arrest situations less adversarial. People are talking about the military and how it can be bad to get equipment from the military. The military apparently is spearheading reliable non-lethal weaponry, which should be at the top of the list. If our elected officials want to step up here, they'll make that the number one priority in the next 2 years. Get us a weapon the police can use that will disable that person and then stand up 30 seconds later after they're in custody. It's unbelievable in this high-tech society, in this late year, 2014, that we're still using firearms that are lethal to bring people into custody to be brought before the bar of justice.
Rick in Massachusetts, independent caller.
Yes, good morning. One of the difficulties that I see is that when the police were taken off the beat and out of the neighborhoods where they got to know the young people, little Johnny started messing up when he was 8, and the police officer could snatch him up by the ear and explain to him what he's doing wrong. I have that situation in my little town. Of all the police officers, there are only 2 that live here. They don't know the citizenry, and the citizenry doesn't know them. That's number one. The other thing that I've noticed is you can basically tell a police officer's attitude based on their haircut. If it's a high and tight military style, those are the ones that I have discovered are more apt to cause problems. So it's not just the police's responsibility. But
now, there's a good item for police officer selection. Look at the haircut. Excuse me, but that one's over the top.
But the citizens' responsibility, that's number one. And number two, I believe that these grievance industry whips up people into violence and anger based on the individual's desire to get press. Two examples in, right off the bat, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. They're here in Ferguson raising all kinds of cane and hell over one very tragic shooting. There's not a word being said about all the murders in Chicago. So I think it's individuals like those and others who are whipping up the violence in these crowds.
Okay. Mr. O'Donnell.
We need to worry about the murders in Chicago. We need to worry about police abuse, and we can do both simultaneously without ideology. We have to worry, absolutely true, that we have a murder problem in Chicago and other cities, and we have to face that. And legitimizing the police and building good rapport with communities will be a win-win for the country. But, again, I don't mean to say, sir, that you're an extremist. It's an extremist thought, though. It's either-or or, you know, side-picking. Real American law enforcement, you know, pledges allegiance to assist people equally. And we can do both. We can have a police force that's respectful and that engages these issues. But it would really be helpful to us as a country if we looked at the footprint of the police, which in many communities is far too big. They're overtasked, and we confronted some of the issues. For example, mental health. Some of the worst issues that the police have had to deal with, shootings where people die, are a direct result of abject failure to step up, have a reliable mental health infrastructure, the number one medical issue in the country by all accounts, by Harvard Medical School. We don't want to fund it. We don't want to fund it. We don't want to confront it. And so we allow the police to be mental health providers, and we confess to be or profess to be shocked when we send police officers armed with weapons, the very worst idea you could think of, to assist people that are in an emotional and mental health crises.
We're talking with Eugene O'Donnell, former police.
Well, we want to thank Mr. O'Donnell for providing that information to C-SPAN and the guest host, Greta Odell Bronner, who's the C-SPAN host for the morning call-in show. And very interesting, and I want to comment that Mr. O'Donnell's trying to cover the whole field of policing, and people shooting at him from all kinds, excuse the pun, all kinds of directions in a call-in type of show. And police work is not that simple. I mean, police work is a very complex job. It's very interesting. It's very motivating. And as I said, I know people with graduate degrees. I know police chiefs at all levels and doctoral degrees. And they don't want to do anything with police work. And a lot of those people with graduate degrees and bachelor's degrees are on the bottom level. Then patrol officers tend to and don't want to do anything else because they can go out on a Saturday night or a Friday night in their city and they can go from a shooting to a second shooting to the delivery of a baby or the assisting in delivery of a baby to help, you know, people run in a, I know one of my friends, the Medal of Honor, the Dallas Police Department, and he ran across the state of Ohio with me once, 242 miles, and he went into a burning house four different times and brought out children each time, and he got their Medal of Honor. And he knew what he spends his time doing, or at least he used to do, on the weekends when he wasn't working. Other times he'd go to prisons and do volunteer work inside of prisons. That's the kind of people we have in policing also, and we should know that. So anyway, folks, that's just about it for tonight. We'll have Vera Lynn sign us off. We hope you can join us next week for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.